New tech solutions seem to be coming at farmers from everywhere, but the future of soil sensing has often been slower to develop. How is advanced engineering pushing the boundaries of what farmers can know and see under the crop canopy? That's today on Field Posts. This is a DTN Progressive Farmer podcast that dives deeper into the most important trends in agriculture to explore the business's cutting edge. I'm your host, Sarah Mock. Before the flashy demo at the farm show and the test drive at the local retailer, a lot of farm tech gets its start in university labs. Today, we're zooming in on what's happening in one small corner of this basic research space to get an idea of what might be in the future of soil moisture and nutrient management. Today, we're joined by senior editor of the Progressive Farmer, Joel Richenberger, who's been following developments out of a Colorado soil sensor lab for a couple of years now. He brings us the latest on some groundbreaking engineering that's helping to carve out a path for the next generation of precision agriculture tech. We'll dive into the specifics today, hearing about the major learnings, how they've been applied to newer, even bigger projects in the space, and catch a glimpse of some other weird and wild tech experiments coming out of university labs and beyond, right after this word from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by MyDTN. In today's environment, it's essential, more than ever, to get the most current and accurate information to help save your valuable resources and continue to be profitable. Get access to all the information you need to deal with this change from DTN. As the leading independent, trusted source of actionable insights and market information, MyDTN gives you accurate weather forecasts, the most extensive database of grain bids, and the most timely news and analysis from our award-winning news team. These features and more are available 24/7 via desktop, laptop, and any mobile device to be with you on the go. Learn more at mydtn.com and start a free 14-day trial. Now, back to the show. Progressive Farmer senior editor Joel Richenberger joins us today to talk about his coverage of the soil sensor tech space. Joel, why don't we start with a little bit of the background and how you maybe first came into contact with this idea?
So the idea is a biodegradable soil probe, which isn't something I had realized the world needed before this. But once you really get into it, it's actually really interesting and why this could be so advantageous. Because the more a farmer knows about the soil that he or she is working in, the more they can adapt to that, the more they can farm that particular piece of ground. And it's one thing to sample your soil once a year or twice a year or something, but the dream for some of these scientists was to be able to sample all the time, anytime, with probes that you have out there, sensors that you have out there throughout the field, and to be able to get that data whenever you need it and whenever you want it throughout the growing season, but also not have to go out throughout the field and dig up your probes so they don't go through a combine tire or something like that. And so that's what this was hoping to address. So a couple of years ago, I think it was 2021, 2020, during the time in COVID when everything blended together, I came across a press release from, I think, University of Colorado talking about some grant money they had received for this research into these soil probes. And it seemed like something up my alley a little bit. And so I followed up on it and they're really eager to have me come down. So I went down to University of Colorado and got a look at what they were working on and got introduced to some of the researchers who'd been working on it. And then I touched base with the guy who was leading the effort. He'd start out at Colorado State, I think, when they had applied for the project, and he'd gotten hired at Kansas State in the time since. And he was based in Manhattan, and I actually met with him in Colorado and really learned about some of what they were doing. Along the way, I really learned a lot about what they had learned and what they were able to produce from it and about some other efforts to generate similar stuff.
You started talking there about the probe and how the probes actually work. I think you got a chance to go and visit the lab where these researchers were working. Talk to us a little bit about what you saw there, what the probes look like. Give us kind of the play-by-play.
So the point when I was down at the lab in Colorado, The probe looked like, it looked like a smaller deck of cards, or maybe three or four or five credit cards stacked on top of each other. It was about that size, and it had two wires that stuck out of it, and the whole thing was going to go on like maybe a wooden stake, and you'd drive the stake into the ground, and then those wires would go out into the soil, and they would measure the electronic resistance in the soil. They were hoping to gather two important things. They were hoping to gather soil moisture levels and nitrogen levels, which is not everything that a farmer could maybe ever want to know about his or her soil, but it would be enough to offer some real benefit. And they're hoping these probes would only cost a buck or two once it was all said and done, if even that much. So you could spread hundreds of them across a field and you would certainly realize some profit from that, hopefully. But they were encased in wax. And that was one of the parts where, again, it just strikes you how creative and intelligent a lot of our engineers and scientists are, because the wax was designed to last for 6 or 8 months. They wanted just enough wax and just the right kind of wax so that when you put it in the ground, the microbes in the soil would immediately start eating at it, because that's what they do. And they wanted it to be able to last 6 or 8 months. And then they wanted, right after harvest or right when it stopped mattering, that's about the time when the microbes were getting through the wax and the probe could almost self-combust at that point. About the time the microbes worked their way through it would be the time you didn't need the information anymore. And then the next year you could come through with some more. And everything in it was supposed to be biodegradable. The wax certainly would be biodegradable and the wood wouldn't be a big deal. And at one point they told me all you'd be left with was a little computer chip about the size of a grain of sand, which would be in the soil and not be a big issue. And they're hoping you wouldn't even need a battery at that time, that you'd have a sensor come over the top and scan the probes and give them just a little bit of juice, essentially, as the sensor was going over. Maybe it'd be mounted on an aerial drone, or maybe it'd be mounted on a center pivot or something. And so it would record just the appropriate data just when it was going over. Now, flash forward a couple of years, that didn't all quite work the same way. And they learned a lot of different things. They learned that they didn't actually need the wax that bad. The wax would help them get consistent measurements. And it turned out that wasn't as big of a problem as they'd initially foreseen it to be. So they weren't using nearly as much wax. The moisture was working really well. They're having a lot of problems with the nitrogen side of it and getting the soil to be tested where it needed to be. And they could get it to work in some soils, but different soils, either sandy or clay or whatever, or wet or whatever it may be, would cause erroneous readings. And then the longer it was buried, the readings would tend to drift and wouldn't be reliable after a week or two. So you certainly weren't getting your 6 or 8 months at that point. Those are all problems. So the grant funding for this, it came from a government grant designed for kind of moonshot ideas. But that money, I think it was, about $1.7 million from the Department of Energy ran out within the last couple of months, I think. So they've officially finished the work, but there was so much that they learned from it that they're still working on. And they're still officially working on the probe and trying to generate something that works, something that has more accurate readings for longer. And that's something they're still actively tackling. But they also learned so many other things. And they can take what they learned from this project and use it in a lot of different ways. For instance, the rate at which the probe was degrading, the guys in the University of Colorado, they actually used those measurements to detect soil microbe activity, which can be valuable for some farmers to know. And that actually ended up being something they could test. So the probe was a probe in and of itself, if that makes any sense. So it's been a lot of fun to dive into and learn about and see some of the creative ways they've been able to use this technology and this data. And this is certainly still early in the process.
We've seen other sensors, especially in soil sensors, and the big challenge there has been that they're often quite expensive. But there's also, I'm thinking of drones, satellite, other ways to get at some of this. And I wonder why the focus on kind of sensors in particular, and why maybe some of those other technologies aren't as effective at getting this information.
Part of the dream is under the canopy throughout the season. And drones and aircraft and satellite, which can all provide great data and great images of the field and really important information, but it can't always get at what's going on under the canopy at a certain point in as the crops grow. And so what they're really hoping for is like consistent, regular, reliable data year round or all season long. And that's not something that like a typical aerial drone would be able to give you. There's other ways to do some of this, and I didn't necessarily get into a lot of that in this story, but there are definitely companies out there working on like a small autonomous robots that would roam up and down the rows of the fields. They would be able to, again, to get under the canopy and get a little more ground level information than an aerial drone is going to be able to get, or maybe satellite data or something like that. It's just all about getting that different information in different ways and what's the best way. And certainly constant infield sensors would certainly be one way. Now, there's obviously some drawbacks to the technology. Maybe the technology is not all quite there quite yet, but it's certainly something they're working on.
I wonder too about the connectivity question. You talked a little bit to it around part of the solution being a sprayer or a tractor or a center pivot that kind of goes over and collects information. But I know a limitation to these kind of technologies in the past has just been unreliable Wi-Fi, lack of connectivity in the field. Does it seem like there's some advances or were some advances made during this project on that front?
I think a little bit. I know they were at the point now where they're investigating ways to make batteries biodegradable or batteries that would work in this. I know at one point they're hoping not necessarily to have a battery and to have, I think they were hoping to have it work like RFID, work a little like if you're driving down the toll lane on the interstate and you got the thing that you drive under the sensor and it records who you are and where you're going. When they were describing it to me, that's how they described it. I think that's a very layman's description of it. But yeah, that's all stuff they're actively working on in terms of getting batteries that would maybe work better that would make this possible. But I think the work goes on there.
Speaking of the work going on, it seems like the team that you met, you mentioned that they're continuing to work on at least stuff related to this. I'm curious whether you can share or whether you learned anything about what are the next steps in a process like this? And I imagine these sensors are not going to be commercially available in the near term, but where might this kind of project be headed?
For the guys in Colorado, and it was Professor Whitting, for his group there, they were interesting because he's not really an ag guy necessarily. He came from like Silicon Valley, California, and he worked for Google for a while and ended up on this project. I don't think he knew a lot of farmers maybe when he started, but certainly along the way seems to have tried to understand what issues farms are dealing with and how some of the technologies he has worked on can help solve some of those issues. And I know he has been able to take a lot of what they learned from these efforts and apply it to other experiments. Like, for instance, I know they are taking some of the sensors that were involved in this project, and they're trying to find ways to put sensors in plants. And they started out, when I was out there, they had this little piece of plastic that was, I don't know, maybe a half an inch by half an inch. And they were telling me, oh yeah, we're going to stick this in the stalk of the corn. And I'll check back in a couple years later, and it turns out, you're not going to believe this, but corn did not like having little half inch by half inch pieces of plastic stuck in the stalk. That didn't necessarily go over well. So they were working on a different kind of sensor. They described it almost that it was like Jell-O that they would be able to put in the plant stock, which again, I didn't actually get to see this. This part of the conversation happened over the phone. So I personally have had a little trouble picturing exactly what this would look like, but they're telling me they're having better results with that. That didn't lead to the imminent demise of the stock of corn. But it shows you where, okay, they start out with to design one thing, and then over time, what they learned from that project leads them other directions. And at least that lab in Colorado, they're going a lot of different directions. And they're talking about little sensors to put on the leaves, like even almost like tattoo, like almost in my head, it was almost like a temporary tattoo on a plant leaf that had some sensing capability and that would be able to deliver information. And a lot of this project, what got the ball rolling on a lot of this was this biodegradable soil sensor. And they gave them the chance to look at what was working, what wasn't, what they needed to overcome. And when's it going to be in the store for a farmer to buy? It could be a while, especially with what's coming from this particular avenue. Or maybe it never even develops that way. Maybe it's some of these derivatives or derivatives of derivatives. Maybe it's not the Jell-O sensor. Maybe it ends up being something else that they learn when they're working on the Jell-O sensor that ends up turning a big corner in agriculture. But it's really interesting because this is where it's happening. This is where that next level of whatever farming is going to be in 10 or 20 or 50 years, maybe this is where some of that's being discovered. And so that's what was so fun for me when it comes to reporting on stuff like this. And maybe this all never ends up being anything. But, you know, when's it actually going to be in stores? I think when I very first talked to them a couple of years ago, I think they told me 2 or 3 years. And 2 years later, they're like, yeah, that didn't work. I didn't have it in me to ask them, what happened to your prediction? But they're definitely progressing. They're definitely still learning. And someday, it sure feels like someday it'll be something.
Yeah, along that same vein, it seems like maybe some other groups, some other researchers are also piggybacking on some of these learnings and trying their hand at some other kind of sensor projects. Could you talk a little bit about what might be in the future for these kind of in-soil sensors?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the groups that I came across when I was doing the research for this story was that they call themselves IoT for Ag, Internet of Things for Precision Agriculture. And it's a National Science Foundation research center. And it involves researchers from Penn, from Florida, University of Florida, Purdue, University of Cal at Merced. And they got $26 million from the National Science Foundation to fund them over 5 years here. And they're working on a lot of these same initiatives. And they see a lot of the same promise in tiny sensors that can go in the field and throughout a field and report data when it's needed and in ways that can really help farmers make decisions. And I mean, they're working with something they call smart chaff, something so small that it can be, again, spread throughout a field and deliver important information. And they're gearing up now. They've been around a little while. They were telling me this summer, a lot of the stuff they've been testing, they're putting out into the field for the first time and hoping to get some kind of real world analysis of it, some real world testing. So it'll be really interesting to see what that turns up and what ends up being a success. My experience with the other group certainly shows that there's probably going to be some bumps along the way, but I think, I mean, he's coming from my side of things. You know, I want it to all work super easy and work well in a magazine story. Coming from their side, it certainly feels like they see it's about the journey they took together rather than necessarily about where they got. So those bumps along the way are what kind of teach the lessons. So it'll be really interesting to see what they learn as they get some of this stuff out in the field to test.
Yeah, definitely something to keep an eye on. A very cool potential solution out there and advancement in the precision ag space, which I think precision ag has been a buzzword in ag for 10, 15 years, a while. And it feels like we definitely got some advances and maybe it's been a little while since it feels like that space has moved forward in a big way. So be interesting to keep an eye on.
Seems like there's never been any shortage of ambition or ideas, but it's fun to see. I don't know. It's fun to see. Yeah. What potentially could be that next step.
Speaking of ambition, I want to ask too about another story that you've worked on about the launch or first public unveiling maybe of an aerial ATV product. Tell me a little bit about getting to witness that in Iowa.
Yeah, so they actually launched it last summer at there was a big farm show in Iowa, in Boone, Iowa, and they launched it there last summer. And then I followed up with a follow-up story, maybe January or February, about some of the work they were doing. And it's really interesting because it's another thing where it feels like the future, but it also feels, I don't know, I'm not sure how to describe my feelings about it. It's a little complex. So the company is Rise Aero Technologies, and they have this aerial ATV, and it looks like it's got six props. It looks like a DJI drone on steroids, big enough to carry a human. And when we were out there last summer, they were showing it off for the very first time, and they'd done the very initial flight for it just a couple of weeks before that, I think. So it had not flown much. And they had a space reserved at the farm show where they could fly it around a little bit. And I guess I'm not sure what I expected, but it did not fly very far. It did not accomplish much. Like, it got up off the ground and then flew about 20 or 30 feet to one side and then came back and landed. And it was super interesting. It's designed to be super simple. It's designed to be available for anyone to be able to pick up and use, honestly, without a whole ton of training. They want to set it up so you don't need to get a private pilot's license to use it. I don't want to misspeak here, so my apologies if I misunderstand the laws. Where comes this? I think what they were pitching me was that they're hoping to have it classified as an ultralight aircraft. And I think to avoid you having to get a pilot's license to fly it. So just to keep things accessible to the everyday farmer and rancher. But I just have to chuckle at the idea of the everyday farmer and rancher ever getting on this thing. But it has limited battery life. It can fly, I think, 20 minutes, 25 minutes. It supposedly can go up to 60 miles an hour. So there's only so far it can go. If you can really go 60 miles an hour, you could theoretically cover 10 or 12 miles before you got to turn around and get back to recharge. And theoretically, that could make it easier for farmers to get around. There's a whole lot of operations in the country that are going to have all their farm ground within 10 or 12 miles of a given point in the center of hopefully of where the sheds are. So that could make some sense. If you needed to zip out and help fix the tractor, if you needed to zip out and heck, even just drop off lunch or something, that could all be possible. If you need to fly around and check the fences, if you need to fly around and check the cattle during calving season or something, I don't know. That's the pitch. Do I really honestly see ranchers zipping around their fields with this? I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe I may need to see it to believe it, but who knows? And I know there's a lot of other use cases for this type of technology. I know in oil industry and a lot of that kind of stuff, I know there's could be some advantage in getting from here to there as fast as possible and not having to take a road. We go where there are no roads. And so certainly there's use cases beyond just farming and agriculture and ranching, but that's definitely one that they identified initially. Now, I think last time I talked to him, I think that still figured in to be a big percentage of where they saw their customers coming from, but not a majority at that point. I think one of the use cases was it could be a fun thing. A billionaire to have on the back of his yacht or something, somebody rich to take along on a vacation or something. So I don't know, it'd be interesting to see what happens. Like, I wasn't quite a believer in the use case in terms of the farm angle, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. We'll see.
Big broad question here. As you are covering this kind of technology and interesting stuff for DTN, whether you've seen anything recently that you've reported on or haven't yet reported on that you think is particularly interesting or that you're going to keep more of an eye on for the rest of this year?
Oh, there's always interesting stuff when it comes to like aerial drones. And that's something that I think you and I have talked about a number of times and that I've reported on a bunch over the years. Just the development of technology in that regard is always interesting. And the increase in capacity, not just the increase in capacity, kind of the novel ways to solve some of those issues. Like, I've always been waiting for a big, okay, when is the craft and the battery and its lifting capability going to get big enough to spray 80 acres? And again, a lot of these people are a lot smarter than me when it comes to this stuff. Hopefully I can maybe write a better sentence than they can, but a lot of them are a lot smarter than me. And they've gotten to the point where they're not trying to build something so big that it can take on a whole field. They're trying to build something maybe that is efficient enough to every trip down the field and back, it can dock, recharge its batteries, reload its spray in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes and then launch again. And that's a more efficient way to spray a whole field in a competitive amount of time than building something so big with such a big battery, so much battery life and so much carrying capacity that could handle 80 acres without stopping. And that's something I'd never thought of. That, wow, you could dock for 90 seconds and get enough battery life and enough spray to make it down and back again. And that's really all you need. But just continuing to study what's going on in that realm is certainly something I'm planning to do as we go into the summer here. The autonomy stuff's interesting as always. And that's something that's happening fast at this point where I feel like a couple of years ago, there were some startups that they were toying around and talking big. And now it's John Deere that's talking big. And it's AGCO and it's Case that are at the table. And that's really interesting stuff. So I really want to dive into some of the big autonomy and there's still a lot of small startups that are really doing really interesting stuff. And I just love those stories, partly from the tech side, but I love it from there's a guy up in Iowa who I'm really excited to go see soon, who started an electric autonomous tractor company. And he's an engineer, he knows what he's doing, but man, he's going head to head with John Deere. And that takes some guts. Like for a career move, rather than try to go work for John Deere, to start your own, it could be a rival in some way, or to go head to head with that technology. I think that's fun and I think that's neat. And the people who believe in what they're doing so much, they're willing to take those risks. That's awesome to me. So it's an awesome story. And so I'm hoping to dive into some of that this summer too.
And then my last question, as always, is just, you hinted at a couple of things there maybe, but I'm curious what other stories or activities you might have in the pipeline that readers should be on the lookout for.
I'm the photographer for the magazine. I'm kind of the lead photographer. And so sometimes I do a little more reporting. Sometimes I do a little more photography. And I'm definitely going into a stretch here where it's going to be a little more photography. I've got a trip to Illinois here in the next couple of weeks for photography for an upcoming story that someone else is writing. I got another trip I got to take to Kansas in the near future to get some photography of wheat harvest, which whatever wheat harvest is going to be in Kansas this year, I'll be there to take some pictures of it. I know it's very delayed at this point, the wheat harvest in Kansas. And after that, what we do the magazine does its annual Young Farmers issue that comes out in December. And And I got to get cracking on getting out to meet with some of those people and get some pictures of them and their operations. So those all can be kind of major factors in where I can get and what I can do and what I can report here in the next couple months.
To read more of Joel's stories and to catch up on other recent reporting about tech and more, check out Up to the Minute Reporting at dtnpf.com or subscribe to the monthly DTN Progressive Farmer magazine. This episode of Field Post was brought to you by the team at DTN Progressive Farmer, with special thanks to Joel Richenberger. This episode was produced and edited by me, Sarah Mock, with support by Greg Hillier, Kylie Swanson, and Susan Payne. And a big thanks to all of you for listening. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And until next time, remember, the future of farming is here. Assess risk by viewing maps specifically designed to show circumstances affecting hay quality. Pennsylvania producer David Graybill said, quote, other weather forecasts were not accurate enough. As DTN Hay Timer shows, it takes the right combination of drying to preserve the crop. I would guess we lost 3 to 4 times the value in crops that it would cost us to keep our DTN subscription for the year. DTN Hay Timer is part of the MyDTN platform. Visit mydtn.com to start a free 14-day trial.